This episode of Literary Treks is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Also, help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day by becoming a Trek FM patron through Patreon. Get access to exclusive content and become part of the team. You'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Taking all these books?
I thought I'd take some light reading, in case I got bored.
Welcome everyone to another episode of Literary Treks, our dedicated books and comic show. I'm your host, Matthew Rushing, and with me, as he is always, is Dan Gunther. Dan, how have you been doing today?
Really well, actually. I don't know how many people out there follow Canadian politics or not, but the province I live in, Alberta, just had their big provincial election yesterday, and I helped out with that, so I'm operating on not a lot of sleep, but...
So, are you going to be running for office someday, or is this something that's just kind of a passion of yours to help out with?
Well, I'm a social studies major, so I love politics and all that kind of stuff, and I don't know, the Star Trek party, I think we could make a run of that.
Yeah, there you go. You could run against the Star Wars party
and you could
have arguments, you know, about who would win in a firefight, the Millennium Falcon or the Enterprise.
And it's the Enterprise, yeah, of course.
This sounds like a a great idea. So I think I could get behind one of these parties. And then you'd have your third party, you know, your outsider party, you know, your BSG or your Babylon 5 or something,
yeah,
you know, that's
upstart, like, third party.
Let us into the party. You know, so, yeah. Oh, goodness.
Yeah, they're not coming to the debate.
This just got way off track. But I'm excited because, you know, recently we have had a run of saying, man, I wonder when this cover is going to be out. And then the next week, we get that cover.
Absolutely.
Well, it happened again, folks. And we're pretty excited because we have some covers to judge, and we've got Seekers 3 and 4 here, Dan. Holy mackerel. These are awesome.
Yeah. No words. I mean, they're gorgeous. I don't know what to say. I mean, I think before we started recording, you said that you thought the original Seekers covers were good, and they were, but man, these are just so much more, and I love them. They're just gorgeous.
Yeah, I mean, I really didn't think that Rob Caswell could really one-up himself, but the man really has gone where no man has gone before, and that's just destroyed his original covers.
Oh, yeah.
You know, with, I mean, wouldn't it be great if you had all four on your wall, like, together?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, why are we not selling these? These are just fantastic, so.
Mm-hmm. No, they need to be sold for sure, like that, because
I would
be first in line.
Yes. Yes. Well, I'm surprised that in some way, you know, Pocketbooks or StarTrek.com isn't doing that. You know, I mean, it's not that hard to print a poster and, you know, sell it on StarTrek.com, and I'm sure there's plenty of fans that would buy these. I mean, they're beautiful, and especially if you just maybe had Seekers 3 or something like that, and that was the only font on the poster, and just so you get more of the picture without the font on there. I mean, I would eat that up.
Oh,
it's so beautiful. So first one here is Long Shot by David Mack that we get, and wow, this is an incredible scene.
Definitely. One thing I do notice is the Sagittarius sure seems to do a lot of plummeting. But you know, like we get it landing or, you know, crash landing a few times in Vanguard and in the first couple Seekers books there. And it looks like something similar might be happening again. I don't know if they're just flying through the atmosphere or coming in for a landing again, but this is just beautiful.
Yeah. I'm wondering, I mean, does somebody say to Terrell, Captain, we're plummeting toward the planet again? And he's like, again? Like, you know, this happens a lot. Mm-hmm. But this is fantastic. I mean, the look of these clouds, there's this lightning storm in the sky. There seems to be some sort of settlement on the ground that this ship is streaking towards. And mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, this is way beyond sufficiently exciting. This is blowing my mind kind of exciting.
I agree completely. Yeah, this is, and the colors and the composition is just, man, I can't wait to crack open this book and see what situation the Sagittarius has found itself in this time, because it looks incredible.
The next book that we have is called All That's Left, and this is Dayton Ward and Kevin Dillmore's book here about the Endeavor, and oh my goodness, I don't want to say that it's my favorite Seekers cover, but I'm going to say it's my favorite Seekers cover.
I would definitely agree with you on that one. The whole, you know, you've got the shiny TOS spacesuits, you've got the really kind of cool space nebula background going on and the gorgeous planet. I think more than any of the other covers, this one really reminds me of those old James Blish novel covers and, you know, that sort of from that sort of era. Like, this one just really evokes that retro feel, and I absolutely love it.
What I really like is that these TOS spacesuits, their environmental suits, really, I mean, they capture the imagination in the sense that they look just like they did on the TV show, and yet at the same time, he's able to make them look just a tad more realistic. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, because it doesn't have that cardboardy look that you have on the TV show. You know, this really, really all fits together. And the fact that you're having these guys standing on a ship, you know, you can see the Endeavor in the background. It almost looks like two guys are beaming in the background too, mm-hmm. on the ship, or beaming out. I mean, you can't tell which one. I mean, this is just super exciting. I mean, mind-blowingly awesome exciting. This is a fantastic cover. And it's been so long, I feel like, since we've had a cover where there's this much happening on the cover. Mm,
definitely. Yeah, usually it's just kind of, you know, one or two or three spaceships kind of arrayed in some kind of situation, maybe a planet in the background. But yeah, this one, there's so much going on. There's actually people on the cover, which we haven't gotten in quite a while, really. I don't have enough good things to say about this. It's absolutely beautiful.
I feel like the last cover where there was this much going on was The Missing, where there were all of those ships streaming towards the new Deep Space Nine, yeah. You know, and that cover just had a lot going on.
Yeah,
you know?
That's true.
But yeah, you're right. We really, and if we get people on a cover, it's usually like a floating headshot.
Right.
And so I just really like this. And in fact, I would say that I would love Pocket to start doing more of this, so that when we're doing our covers, we're getting more of the covers that you get with the Cross Cult books there in Germany.
Right.
Where you're creating artwork that is, you know, these new characters from the Titan books or New Frontier. You know, you see those great renditions of those characters, like Mares or something like that. That's how we all think of them, because they're the ones who are actually giving us those renditions. I really wish Pocket would get an artist to help them create some of those things, so we could add different scenes to our books than just, hey, look, it's the Enterprise E again, you know, which I'm sure probably sells books in some ways, mm-hmm. but it's not really all that exciting anymore just to see the Enterprise E on the book with a nebula in the background.
Right. Yeah. No, I'm thinking, yeah, for example, the Crimson Shadow, which was, I think, my favorite novel to come out that year. And the cover was just, you know, really kind of there. It was lackluster and I didn't really like it. And I'm really glad I didn't judge the book solely by that cover, because that book was incredible and it deserves a cover like this.
You had in that one, you had the Enterprise E on it and a crimson sheet behind it, basically. It was a nebula. But yeah, it was very frustrating that that was one of the best books of that year and just one of the best books on, I read that year, because it was on my list of 10 best books for that year. Mm-hmm. And that the cover had so little to really do with what was happening. I mean, you know, where's Cardassia in that picture? Mm-hmm. You know, why don't we have that there? I don't know. It just, I'm with you. These covers do so much for the books. And I think maybe this signals that Pocket is maybe willing to try some more things, because I think this has been really successful for them. I've not heard a bad word really about these Seekers books. People seem to be loving them. And I think we're also loving the artwork. You know, I know that anybody who has gone to any of the conventions where they've had some of the posters that they give away from these, I have one that Dayton sent me, and it's beautiful.
Oh, man.
Yeah, and it's on my wall here right above my computer. I'm looking at it right now. And yeah, this artwork, it deserves to be available to us because it's so good. It's that good. And, you know, there's no better statement for art than to say, yep, I want that on my wall mm-hmm. all the time.
Yeah.
Because I want to be able to look at it. And that's what we get with these covers. And thank God for these guys really believing in Rob Caswell and what he was doing. They saw it, they loved it, and thought, what if we put stories with these great pictures? What a great idea.
Definitely. I'm so glad that that happened and that project got off the ground, and now we're getting these novels, 3 and 4 now. I mean, that's great. I want this series to continue, and it also to continue getting this amazing artwork that we've been getting. It's really, it's a gift in the Treklit universe for sure.
Oh, no kidding. It is incredible. Well, I do want to mention to everyone, and I'll be linking you to the article, so go check it out. But where we got these covers from was this great article on StarTrek.com about what goes into a Star Trek novel cover art, and it is by Rob Caswell. And he explains kind of his process as well as getting to see these beautiful pieces of art. So if you haven't seen them and if you'd like to kind of know a little bit more about what goes into creating these, it's a great article to read. And there's a link there for his DeviantArt page where he has a bunch more of his Seekers ideas there. And if you haven't perused that, guys, you are in for a treat. So I'll put that in the show notes, and I hope you'll go head over there and take a look at that. Because honestly, if you're loving the Seekers art here, you got to see some of the other things he's done. It's fantastic. Well, Dan, we're going to do something that is exciting today. We're going to start a brand new ebook miniseries that actually began in 2006, and it was to celebrate the 40th anniversary of Star Trek. And actually, our friend Keith DeCandido was the person that edited this series, and it's called Mere Anarchy, chronicling the aftermath of the disaster on the planet Mystico, as it affected both the natives and Kirk and his crew over the entire course of the TOS era. So we're talking from right before he gets the Enterprise and where no man has gone before, all the way to the movie era. And there's also a paperback omnibus of this series that was released in March 2009. Before we start, quick question, because I was reading this today and I was like, huh, I've read this before. I totally forgot that I've read this series before, and it has no bearing on whether it was good or not. It was just one of those things where it's like, sometimes I forget which Star Trek books I've read because I've read so many. Have you read this one before, Dan?
I have not read this one before. I remember when it came out in the paperback omnibus, and I saw it in my local bookstore, and I remember thinking about picking it up, and then I never did. So yeah, I've never read this one before. This reading just this first story is my first exposure to this at all, and I've not read any of the other stories yet. So,
well, I'm really excited to be getting into this, and So you were put some things on the outline here, as and I kind of did too, so we kind of have an amalgamation of some of our thoughts. But you were just talking about the setting of this and how it really has that feeling of the, you know, where no man has gone before era, which is something that, especially with the Kirk Enterprise, we don't get that very much because, you know, we kind of jump right out of that and we never visit that again. And so what did you kind of think about the fact that, you know, this at this point, Mitchell hasn't gone crazy and turned into some weird godlike thing and tried to kill everyone. And of course, we have Dr. Piper as well instead of Dr. McCoy here. And so, and then, of course, Sulu is, you know, an astrophysics instead of being the helmsman. And so, yeah, I mean, this is something that doesn't get done a lot in books because I don't think the time period's supposed to be that long. Mm-hmm. But what did you end up thinking about having a story take place before Where No Man's Gone Before?
Well, I thought personally that it was really cool seeing the different crew in these different roles that we've not seen them in much before. And especially I thought kind of exploring that relationship between Kirk and Mitchell and kind of seeing their friendship as it is when he's not a megalomaniacal godlike thing was really, really cool. Now, I know there's a trilogy of books, and I've not read them. My Brother's Keeper, that kind of explores that a little deeper. But I've not read those, so I've never really seen that relationship explored before. So I thought that was really great, you know, to get that kind of everyday feel between the two of them rather than the extraordinary circumstances we get in Where No Man Has Gone Before. Also, Sulu, I thought, as an astrophysicist, it was cool to see him in that role, but also really cool to see him kind of take the helm and Kirk kind of realizing, oh, hey, this guy's got some skills in that area too. Good to see, you know. It's kind of neat.
It was really nice because, you know, the feeling of this story, it just feel everything feels newer and the Kirk feels more raw, you know, even more so than in many of the TOS books that we've seen before. And I think that was a really interesting thing to see. You know, he's been out in space, it feels like maybe for a few months, and it almost feels like they're, you know, close to Earth. They're not that far away. Mm-hmm. Because they're going to be traveling back to Earth in space dock, where Dr. Piper is going to, you know, be disembarking from the Enterprise and retiring. And we're going to be getting, of course, Dr. McCoy. So that's about a few months away. So these are really just this could literally be the first mission for Kirk and as Captain the Enterprise. Even though you get the feeling that he's been on there for a few months, maybe.
Yeah.
And so it's really interesting to kind of see that character, specifically Kirk, with the rawness. We didn't get enough shouty Spock, though.
I did notice there was one part where I think they mentioned that Spock raised his voice to be heard over the whine of the engines or something like that. And I thought that was kind of a nice little bit of a nod to that, you know, shouty Spock that we got. Full power, you know, or whatever he yells.
Yes. Coming out of warp now, Captain.
Spock, I'm right here. You don't have to shout.
Exactly. Yeah, I do. I like this setting. It is something to where, you know, I know we're setting up this storyline, but I kind of wanted this to be just a little bit longer so we could explore this world just a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Because there aren't actually even a lot of scenes between Gary Mitchell and Kirk,
right?
Which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, we kind of just get a hint, just little kind of bits about their time at the Academy and Kirk wanting him to be his first officer kind of thing. But yeah, we don't get a lot of exploration of it.
Well, and it was really cool to find out, you know, that Kirk did want him as first officer and he was overruled by an admiral mm-hmm. who said, no, it needs to be Spock. And actually Mitchell had agreed with that admiral, even though Kirk didn't. So I thought that would have been kind of maybe an interesting thing for them to, you know, maybe have this set closer to when Kirk and Mitchell had already been having that discussion, and so we could have maybe seen that discussion in the book as if it was, you know, something that was still going on. Mm. I thought that would have been a cool thing. But yeah, it was, this is a neat period to be in. It's not a long period, and so we don't get tons of stories in this.
Yeah.
But I like that you get that feeling that this is one of the first things that Kirk goes through as a captain. Mm-hmm. And I like that. So
yeah, and there's all kinds of nice just little touchstones that Ward and Dilmore put in there. Like I noticed a couple mentions of lateral power and that kind of thing, which is, you know, a phrase they used in that episode when they were escaping the barrier at the edge of the galaxy and stuff, and not one we hear later on. So it just kind of reminds you of where they are in Star Trek history and that kind of thing. It was really nice, very, very nice attention to detail by the authors.
It just makes me wonder how many times that they watched The Cage and Where No Man Has Gone Before to kind of get that framework, mm-hmm. you know, that really early Star Trek, so that there are some of those little touch notes in there to say, hey, yeah, we realize that we're not just in your normal TOS episode here.
Yeah. No, it's clear the effort's been put in, and it's really appreciated for sure. So the other thing I kind of wanted to talk about was, well, the dilemma that this planet Mystico is facing. I loved how the authors were really able to kind of create this danger to the planet and the experience. And it feels very, very real, both like the stakes for our characters that we're familiar with, but also for the people of the planet below. I found myself like really identifying with them, and it felt very, very real. What did you feel about that whole situation?
I think they do a good job in a really short time frame to create this world that, you know, they have created warp drive, but it's only you know, certain countries on this planet that kind of are a part of that, and they're not unified, and so the Federation has been made aware of their presence. They've sent kind of a research team there that is all in, you know, makeup and everything to make them look like the indigenous population, to kind of feel out where they might be when it comes to, you know, their science and how close they might be to maybe becoming part of the Federation, but undercover, you know, like who watches the Watchers or Star Trek Insurrection kind of thing. They're undercover. I thought that was really interesting. And so seeing how those crew members react to the situation, how close they've come to these Mystico people, and just the general population, you know, it kind of felt somewhat close to something akin to we might have on Earth, you know, maybe in like 40, 50 years maybe or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah, it felt like...
So it didn't feel too off.
Yeah, it felt like a very realistic kind of depiction of, you know, a society that would be reaching this stage of development. And I really liked that it was, you know, a country on this planet that they're dealing with rather than the planet as a whole. That's not something we see a lot of in Star Trek, and I thought that was kind of a really interesting way to approach this story.
Well, and that creates the whole dilemma of the story, because Starfleet with the Prime Directive, how do we deal with this planet, you know, and that limits our options because we are, you know, we need to uphold our Prime Directive. We need to abide by that rule. And so how we help this planet is with one hand tied behind our back almost, because we can't do everything that we could do if we could make the people aware that we're here.
Right.
So I think that was really an interesting thing. And, you know, of course, I also picked up on this interesting tidbit. You know, every few weeks or every couple months, my wife and I, we travel down to Portland here from Washington to see her parents. And we actually pass by a Jehovah's Witnesses compound, which is, it's one of their places that they have set up, and you'll see them around the country for if the end of the world comes.
Hmm.
And So it felt very interesting to read this story and kind of see that this religious sect here is very much like that, that they have had these compounds built into the mountains, and that's where some of the survivors of this planet are going to come from. And you can already tell that this is probably going to create some interesting divisions with different places and peoples as this story progresses later on. Mm-hmm.
I really liked the government official that we kind of follow through the course of the story when she hears, you know, who has survived and or who's talking kind of thing. And she kind of pauses for a little bit. And the guy says, oh, is there something wrong? And she's like, well, it seems that these are these religious guys. Is that a problem? Well, no, but moving on. And it's just like, okay, so this is a story element that's going to come into play later. Okay, good to know kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, it was interesting because like lots of Star Trek, we are taking bits and pieces from our world and kind of sprinkling them into what we have around us, mm-hmm. and putting that into the story and see how that'll play out. And so it was just interesting to me because, like, I pass this a lot. So, I've actually seen, these places. There's actually one in Texas as well that's on the way to where we would go to, like, you know, hike in New Mexico or Colorado. We'd end up passing it all the time too. So
that's really fascinating.
it is very, very interesting. You know, they're set up to be able to support people, farming wise and all sorts of things. So, it was really interesting to see that in this story. So, Well, one of the things that was very interesting is this does feel like this is the first time that Kirk is truly feeling this burden of command and that the responsibility that comes with it and the weight that comes with it when something doesn't quite go your way as a captain. Mm. And I thought that was a really interesting thing here to see, especially with in light of the conversation that he and Piper have as well, of basically Piper saying, you need to let this go because it just happens. There's nothing you can do about it. You're going to win some, you're going to lose some. Mm-hmm. And you need to be able to let that go and not beat yourself up over something that you only have so much control over.
Yeah. And I mean, this really becomes a hallmark of the Kirk character over the course of the series and the movies. This is really something that Jim Kirk is all about, is this burden of command, this, you know, heaviness that he feels when, you know, he's responsible for the actions of every member of his crew and the entire ship. And, you know, if something happens on his watch, he really, really takes it to heart. Like, you know, we joke in Star Trek about red shirts dying and that kind of thing, but we see Kirk's reaction when that happens, and it's very personal. And he takes everything that happens under his command very personally. Like, you know, it's his fault. And there was an interesting line where he says, his internal monologue is something along the lines of, you know, if we'd succeeded, it would be due to the resourcefulness of my crew and the hard work of Spock and Sulu and Scotty and all these people. But if we fail, that's me. It's on me 100%. And I thought that was just a really kind of interesting insight into how he thinks, and not entirely something that I think a rational person would agree with wholeheartedly, but it's very much what we get with Kirk over the years. And it's, you know, really clear to see that the authors really have a good take on his character and really know what makes Kirk tick.
Well, what was really interesting too about it was, if they were to follow the letter of the law of the Prime Directive, they wouldn't help this planet at all. Mm-hmm. The planet would be toast. I mean, literally toast. So you might as well just spread some jam on it and be done, because this planet wouldn't be here. So
right.
The fact that they do anything to help this planet and they keep it from being completely annihilated and give it some kind of chance. Mm-hmm. You know, it was interesting. I didn't necessarily understand Kirk's response, honestly, because and maybe this is something that will happen later on, but I feel like the Kirk later on would be looking at what they were able to accomplish and be able to see that if they hadn't been there at all, everybody would have died. Mm. And so maybe that's what they're going to try and do throughout this series is, and that's one of the cool things about it is because it's going to last the entire TOS run. We're going to kind of see these characters move and change and grow beyond where they are now. And that's a pretty interesting thing.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if it's, yeah, maybe his youth and inexperience and kind of, you know, becoming a captain and getting command of the Enterprise and feeling like, oh, we can do anything. We can, you know, I can be the hero and save everyone.
I can be your hero, baby.
Oh, you got to sing it like Shatner, though.
I don't know how you would do that.
No, that would be pretty tough.
Actually, he would just talk it because, you know, like William Shatner
exactly,
does in his
albums. Exactly, yeah, the spoken word album.
I can be your hero, baby.
I can
kiss away your pain.
Exactly. Perfect. But yeah, no, I wonder if that's kind of coming into play, like the idea that, you know, kind of he can do anything and when that fails, maybe he just takes it so hard because he's second guessing himself. There must have been something that he could have done to make this plan succeed. And when it doesn't succeed fully, it's, you know, he takes it so personally. It's that would be really hard to live with, I'd imagine.
As we move forward in the series, you know, we see him take things, you know, hard. And personally, but I think we also do see him grow, and that's one of the cool things about this series, again, is we're going to see that play out, this idea that the characters metamorphize into something different, you know, and so they start here, and it's just the larva we're dealing with, and by the very end of this series, we're going to see the butterflies they become.
Yeah.
You know, this is, that is really interesting because, you know, this is one of Kirk's first missions that we kind of see as being in command, fully in command, you know, as the captain of at least the Enterprise,
mm-hmm.
a ship of this stature, you know, the flagship of the fleet. It is interesting to watch this guy, handle these things that are going to be unfortunately second nature later on. You know, he's going to deal with them a lot more, so it's just going to get rougher from here, buddy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're going to lose your ship and your best friend, and yeah so
it's,
I mean, it's I think what is nice again here is the fact that we are at the very, very beginning of Star Trek, and watching the progression of these characters is really cool. And like all good Star Trek stories, this one touches on the Prime Directive. And I don't think of too long of a discussion, but I wondered what you thought of how the Federation deals with the Prime Directive here, because they seem to be breaking the rules, at least that we know them, that they would even be talking to this planet in the first place that isn't unified. And yes, they have warp drive, but it's not shared with everyone. It was very interesting that they were, you know, revealing themselves whatsoever to anyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of an interesting situation that they've set up here. With this planet and where it is exactly in its cultural and technological development. I have a really hard time exactly discussing the Prime Directive in situations like this, because I completely disagree with the idea that if, like, a civilization is doomed to be destroyed, that the Prime Directive says, oh, well, we should just let that happen. You know, I know there's a fine line between that and playing God and all that kind of thing, but I don't know. I feel like if you have the resources and you can save millions or billions of lives, you should do it. I don't know. I have a really, so, I mean, I completely agree. I think the Starfleet should be doing everything they can to help this planet. And, yeah, as far as talking to the population, I don't know. That's a little dicier. I think what they do, letting the government decide what gets revealed and what doesn't get revealed, is probably best. But as far as the actual taking the actions to save the people of the planet, or at least as many of them as they're able to, I think if it's feasible, they should do it. But that's just me.
It's an interesting question, too, because if they had just revealed themselves to the planet, I feel like it seems like there was more they were going to be able to do than just deploy these, you know, deflector shield robots in space that creating this massive deflector shield that are hopefully going to divert this pulsar's energy away, X-ray energy away from the planet. And so they're kind of dancing the line here and having it both ways. And but it was interesting. It's like, you know, if you're really going to try and save the planet, just go all out, you know, like do what you have to do to save the planet, and it's probably going to be fine. And yeah, I don't know how I feel about it, because, you know, because I'm not a survival of the fittest person in the first place. Yeah, the Prime Directive doesn't really make sense to me at all.
Mm-hmm. At least in that context,
Yeah, but when you think of it, when it comes from that very scientific, humanistic standpoint that Star Trek comes from, the Prime Directive, it would be the Prime Directive. We're not out here to pretend we're some sort of gods. So if nature is deciding that this planet is doomed, then who are we to say it's not? We shouldn't be involved in changing the evolution of a species. Whereas, yeah, I'm kind of with you. Like, we can help people and protect people, we should do that. So, but I come at it from a completely different side.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that's a tough thing, you know, and I think that's where, why maybe one of the reasons they created it is just because it creates great drama, you know, who knows?
And I mean, it certainly does in some instances for sure. So yeah, that makes sense. I also think like Star Trek is about different things. And I think part of what Star Trek is about is technology and using it to, I don't want to say conquer nature, but, you know, overcome limitations kind of thing. So it's kind of funny because those two aspects of Star Trek come into conflict a little bit. The idea that, you know, you can't interfere and you can't do anything to change things, but technology makes things better and we can overcome them. You know, it's kind of interesting that Star Trek just, you know, kind of has those things battling each other. And it would be nice if, I don't know, I'm a do-gooder. So, you know, as far as influencing a culture or something like that, or introducing technology to a people that, you know, don't have the maturity to deal with it. Yeah, that's one thing. Stopping an asteroid or a pulsar that's going to wipe out a civilization before it has a chance to grow, that's another thing in my mind. So
yeah, no, and I'm completely in agreement with you. So I think it just makes it's one of the things that makes for a great question in this storyline. So one of the neat things about this we talked about is that this series is different than other ebooks in that it is really playing the long game. So it is setting up this story, and there kind of is an endpoint for this story, but it really is meant to be continued on into the other stories. And I really like that, because it does create that feeling of, we are celebrating the 40th anniversary of Star Trek, and so we're going to tell this big, massive story that spans the entire TOS time frame, and something that's going to touch all of these characters' lives. And I think that's really interesting. And much in the same way that David R. George III did his Crucible series, where for him, it was the City on the End of Forever that everything was kind of revolving around for the three main characters. So I really like this. I think it's really, really smart to do this type of series where, yeah, you read this first book, but it's, you know, the story isn't finished, and it's okay that it feels a little unfinished, because it should, because you should want to just go ahead and pick up that, you know, very next book. And I think that's completely fine. And it makes for, I think, a nice celebration of what they were trying to do back in 2006.
Yeah, definitely. I really like, I think I mentioned a couple things where you can tell they're leaving little plot threads dangling that they're going to pick up later. I really like that idea of having this continuing ongoing story and how it affects the lives of the characters over the entire TOS era. I think it's pretty interesting. Like, you know, this came out to celebrate the 40th anniversary. We're going to be reading it kind of heading into TOS's 50th anniversary. It's kind of neat to celebrate the history of Star Trek with stories like this. And, you know, next year we're going to be getting, of course, some 50th anniversary stories. There's another TOS trilogy coming out of novels. And I'm sure there's probably other things that we don't know about yet that are coming. So it's kind of neat when, you know, there's a little bit of a celebration themed thing like this. And this one, especially going through the entire history, it's going to be a fun ride. And I'm really interested to see where the characters go and how this situation affects them over the years.
Well, it really just reminds me of my favorite Star Trek book song, which is Plot Threads, you precious little plot threads. How are you, plot threads? Yeah, you can just see Data singing that himself. Oh,
absolutely.
Yeah, that's what he does sitting there. You know, he's talking to Moriarty.
Yeah. And he's reading a novel.
In Jeff Lang's books, you know. So
perfect. Geordi's like, I thought you weren't going to sing that anymore, Data. You've got to stop.
Yeah, Geordi's just face-palming at that point. Well, Dan, I was going to ask you, like, should we rate this? But I feel like we should probably just hold off until we finish the entire series, because it doesn't really feel fair to judge this book by itself, because it's not a complete story. And I think that's okay. And so I think we'll kind of hold off for our ratings until we get to the very end of this story. And then we can kind of judge it as a whole, because each of these stories is going to be building on the other. And I just felt like that was fair.
No, that makes a lot of sense. That said, I will say that I really enjoyed this story. And it's really made me interested to see where the rest of the story goes. You know, I really enjoy Kevin Dillmore and Dayton Ward's collaborations, generally speaking, and this was a really good one. So, yeah, I look forward to kind of seeing it as a piece of the greater whole as we move forward and, you know, giving our ratings at that point.
Well, I'm with you. I think that everybody should be on this journey with us. It's a lot of fun. Like we said, you know, you can get this in ebook format, or you can get the big ominous paperback out there, probably still somewhere used. So you may even be able to find it on Amazon at this point as well. But I think it's definitely a journey worth taking. It's a great 6-part story, and I look forward to be able to jump into the next part soon.
Well, Matthew, Like you said, I'm really looking forward to continuing this journey and seeing where this goes from here. But in the meantime, you know, I had a lot of fun talking about this first part, Kirk's indecision and all of the plot threads that are dangling, waiting to be picked up in the next volume. So this has been a lot of fun.
It really was. I really enjoyed it as well. And hopefully, too, we'll be able to get a hold of that CD, Data's Star Trek book songs, and we'll be able to play more as we go along. But Data's Star Trek book songs is not the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM the past week. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Set this movie at the end of the 5-year mission. Skip ahead 5 years, you know, kind of like Dark Knight or whatever, and then say, okay, we've had all these adventures, blah, 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 blah. And now we're at the end. We're about to go home, you know, and it's been, a fun time was had by all.
Earl Grey.
Again, you know, because it's January, my ship was shot beyond the bounds of normal interstellar travel to the center of the galaxy, but we were back in time for tea.
The orb.
They're not even right. Thinking about it at this point. Okay, how do we start the resistance? Yeah, yeah, yeah. How do we do all this?
Yeah.
Because they have become comfortable with where they are and thinking that they're doing all they can. And yet we know, as the audience, that they're not.
To the journey! I want you to say right now in front of our friends, okay? And in front of me and the Lord Almighty, what is your favorite season?
Okay, this isn't the favorite season.
I want you to tell me what your favorite season is.
Daniel and Darren, promise we won't ever be like this.
The Ready Room.
So what's the deal? You know, does Tom have a dad we don't know about?
Apparently.
Because who was this guy that he was remembering as his dad?
Was that Nick Locarno's dad?
That was Nick Locarno's dad, yes.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
But I mean, here's the question, John. If you're living Fight Club, then, you know, we have to ask. If you could fight anyone, who would you fight?
William Shatner.
All right.
Literary Treks.
The main storyline here is the battle for the Vulcan soul. They are one of the most logical races, and yet they have an intensely spiritual aspect to them.
Axanar, the official podcast.
You were there. Mm. How long did we wait for them to try and reach that footprint?
Oh, man. It was
10 minutes?
It was at least as long as the Enterprise penetrating V'ger's outer shield to getting into the actual machine core.
The 602 Club.
So, as far as the realism question is concerned, whether or not it's the right thing to do, it's the Marvel way to do it. I mean, I think that's the defining difference between Marvel and DC.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows, find out what we've been talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. Guys, wherever you get your podcasts, you can help us out in a big way. If you love what we do and just want to be able to share that and have more people find it, hit that subscribe button in iTunes. Also, give us a star rating and review. If you're not in iTunes or you're not an Apple user, you can get our shows everywhere. Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone. You can stream and download the MP3 file. And of course, you can grab the RSS link as well from the website. Another great way to help the network is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. We are a listener-supported network, and without you guys, it's kind of impossible for us to do this. It's a volunteer basis only. There's a lot of costs that go into doing this. And so if you'd like to know more, go to patreon.com/trekfm. You'll find the goals that we have we're trying to reach, as well as the perks that come with those. You got some great perks there. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. You can contact us at trek.fm/contact. You can leave us a voicemail. Look in the sidebar of the show page or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm. We're on Twitter at trekfm. Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. And we're on the Babel Conference, which is our listeners-only discussion group. Great place to have a Star Trek discussion, Star Trek books discussion. Just type Babel into the search field in Facebook or go to the website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar. And we also have a Goodreads group. We've got our bookshelves there that have our previously covered books. We've got our currently reading section so you know what's coming up. And we also have some great conversations going on over there about books and comics as well. I'd really like to thank some of our associate producers. We've got Will Wynn. He's on Twitter at Will_Wynn. And of course, he's on the Babel Conference. He is the associate producer for The Orb and Earl Grey and is Trek FM's content coordinator. Also, a big thank you to Ken Tripp and his support in the network and being an associate producer on Literary Treks as well. Now, Dan, when you're not beating yourself up over a glass of Saurian brandy because you just couldn't save that planet, where can we find you?
Oh, man, the fifth one this week, Matthew. I'm losing planets like you wouldn't believe.
What the heck are you doing, Dan? Fifth planet this week?
It's related to the Section 31 mission. I shouldn't have said that. Anyway, you can find me online. My website is www.treklit.com, and on there I review Star Trek novels, both old and new. I'm on Facebook at facebook.com/treklitreviews. And I'm on Twitter at Kertrats, K-E-R-T-R-A-T-S. And you can find me, of course, on the Babel Conference and on our Goodreads discussion group, talking about Star Trek books and whatever else strikes our fancy. And Matthew, when you're not on the Bridge of the Enterprise trying to chat up Yeoman Smith, or is it Jones? I can't remember which.
I can't ever remember. Yeah. Well, of course, you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. Also do The Orb with Christopher Jones, where we talk exclusively about Deep Space Nine. And then I'm on the 602 Club. We pick a great new geeky topic each week and talk about that. So this latest episode was The Age of Ultron. We just saw that and all talked about that. So that was a lot of fun. And then, of course, you can find me on my own personal blog at 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And until next time, live long and read on.
What do you call that, light reading?
To each his own, number one.